Pick up where we left off last week in Genesis chapter 18. Which is a pretty monumental text for certain. And we have spent a couple of weeks at least on this, and we're at the back end of it now, and things will move on a little bit faster towards the end of the chapter, I think. But at any rate, what we last considered in the text is how we have the Lord appearing to Abraham. We have two angels as well also appearing to Abraham. And there's the discussion about Sarah bearing a child. And then there was this initial discussion of the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. And it was fascinating to see why God brought that up. And the realities is that Abraham doesn't have an Old Testament like we have. He certainly didn't have a New Testament. And so what he has is a faith in what's been revealed to him. Faith comes by hearing, it always has, right? Romans 10, 17. Faith comes by hearing, hearing by the Word of God. And so his faith is in the Word of God. His faith is in what God has revealed to him by His Word. But he doesn't have what we have. And he doesn't have what others would have after him. And so this discussion of Sodom and Gomorrah is very fascinating. I mean, we look back at it and see it from, you know, this is way in the past. But what's happening here is God saying in the text, I need to reveal this to Abraham so that he can understand, as we talked about last week. And so this Sodom and Gomorrah situation, the bottom line of God deciding to talk to Abraham about it, the bottom line came from the mouth of God himself, the fact that the idea that Abraham needs to know about this so that he can warn his descendants after him. Abraham needs to know about this so this can be an example, not just, hey, remember what happened one time when all of a sudden, you know, these cities just were engulfed in smoke? I mean, what a crazy, strange event that was. And then, you know, just go on. It wasn't like that. It was God saying, I'm going to tell Abraham this so that he can know and that he can teach his children and their children and their children on and on and on. This is an example, not just some crazy event that occurred, but this was a judgment from God upon these wicked cities. And so that they would learn, and that's what we see, Peter talks about that in his epistle, that Sodom and Gomorrah were an example. So if it wasn't revealed to Abraham and we didn't have it in, you know, Genesis chapter 19, the next chapter, we didn't have it revealed to us, we wouldn't know anything about it. We wouldn't know why these things happened. But God chose to reveal these things so that they would be an example to us. And really, that opens up a broad application there for us, because we can look at the Old Testament through that kind of eyesight, and even a lot of the New Testament, a lot of the examples in the New Testament through that kind of perspective, and we see that God has revealed these things to us. He's taught us these stories. He's taught us these accounts. For our example, you know, an example that's laid before us of what we need to do or what we need to be warned by, what we ought not to do or follow after. And so, so much of the Old Testament. This is not just law, you know, article after article of law. There's all kinds of accounts and God telling us stories of people that are like him, He also tells stories of people that are altogether not like him. And so that's what we're dealing with. We have this situation in Genesis 18 where he's talking to us about Abraham, who is like God and a friend of God. And he and Abraham are talking about people that are not like God. And so that's the situation there. Let's see. So God tells Abraham that he's going to go down and look at Sodom and Gomorrah. It's interesting he doesn't tell Abraham there, verse 20 and 21. It's interesting he doesn't tell Abraham, I am going to just destroy them. He never says that. He says, I'm going to look. I'm going to observe. And this shows how much Abraham knows about Sodom and Gomorrah. Because Abraham's response, notice verse 22, then the men turned away from there and went toward Sodom. Those are the two angels. Went toward Sodom. It says, but Abraham stood still before the Lord, and Abraham came near and said, would you also destroy the righteous with the wicked? Suppose there were 50 righteous within the city. Would you also destroy the place and not spare it for the 50 righteous that were in it? So you notice Abraham right away, what is the first word out of his mouth is, would you also destroy the righteous with the wicked? So he has the word destroy on his hand, and God never used that. And that tells us that Abraham knows what's going on in Sodom and Gomorrah. All right? It's not that he's unaware of these things. He knows of it, and he also knows what's fitting for the city, what kind of judgment is fitting for the city. He knows that if God passed by there, that would be the decision made, is that this place needs to cease. And so so that is very fascinating. Abraham understands these things and knows these things. Lot, his nephew, lives there. And I'm sure that that has a lot to do with Abraham's intercession here on behalf of, not on behalf of the city. And I think that's important to recognize is he's not really interceding on behalf of the city. He's interceding on behalf of the righteous. And I think that's, as I said, really important. Little tweak there, one little tweak, and we might misunderstand exactly what Abraham has in mind. The idea is he doesn't want the city destroyed, not on behalf of the wicked, but he makes it clear it's on behalf of the righteous. He doesn't want the city destroyed because of the righteous. So his question to God is, some might think that this is dangerous to respond to God in this way. Would you also destroy the righteous with the wicked? And as I said, we might think, well, you know, Abraham, I don't know if you should be talking to God in that way, or even talking to him at all about whatever decisions he's going to make. He's going to make his decisions, and that should be it. That should be final. But I want to make mention that this, what Abraham is doing, this is what God has really invited Abraham to do. God bringing this up was not just, Abraham, I'm going to tell you about these things because I want this to be an example for you and for your descendants, for the children of Israel, that they don't be this way. I don't want them to be this way because this is the judgment that befalls those who act in this capacity. It's not just that I'm going to tell them so it's an example, but the way God presents the situation to Abraham is an invitation for a conversation, an invitation for a discussion between God and Abraham. And so essentially God has asked for this back and forth conversation between Abraham and himself. Abraham, to take that a step forward, just one step more. Not so much that God has asked for this conversation, but also that God is giving Abraham the opportunity to do what he expects Abraham to do, which is to intercede. And this is something we see throughout the entire biblical record, is intercession for other people. We don't have people, the people of God are not selfish, right? And they're not looking out for themselves and that's it, but they look out for their brethren, they look out for others. Of course, this expands to the whole world as in terms of you know, loving your brother, you know, loving the Lord your God, but also loving your neighbor and all those kinds of things. And so the idea of stretching your arm out to in aid and also asking for intercession on behalf of other people, this is what God desires out of us, not to be sitting here only thinking about ourselves, only be thinking about everything that we're doing or what we want, and only coming to God in prayer and talking, this is what I want today. I want this, and I want this, and I want this, and I want this, and you know, whatever Christmas list we have for him that day. These are the presents I would like today. And turning prayer into that, it's just not something we see in the Bible. We don't have those kinds of examples in Scripture, but we do have a great deal of intercession. And God desires this out of us. He's asked us to pray with intercession. He has asked us to intercede on behalf of others. The prophets are individuals in the Old Testament what was the job of the prophet? Well, to prophesy, okay, to reveal God's word to the people. But what was it all about? Is these men, these prophets, you read through the book of the prophets, they were intercessors, all right? They stood in between. You know, God calls for a man, even a single man. Isn't that in Ezekiel or maybe it's Isaiah? My memory fails me right now exactly. But, God looking for a man, just one man to stand in the way and intercede on behalf of his own people. So this concept is all over the place, and we find it here in the very beginnings of the Bible. You know, all the way back in Genesis chapter 18, where Abraham, of all people, is an individual who's interceding here on behalf of the righteous, on behalf of his brother, his nephew, not his brother, in that way, but they're brethren, that's the idea. So he raises the point there in verse 24. Suppose there were 50 righteous within the city, would you also destroy the place and not spare it for the 50 righteous that were in it? Far be it from you to do such a thing as this, to slay the righteous with the wicked, so that the righteous should be as the wicked. Far be it from you. Shall not the judge of all the earth do right? Once again, you think, Abraham here, I don't know if you ought to be doing this kind of thing. But as I said, this is exactly what God desires out of Abraham. He wants this kind of mentality coming out of Abraham. The idea of save, show mercy, show compassion, because this is God. And Abraham is a lot like God. He's got a lot of the same, he's a human, in that he fails and he has times of great immaturity and foolishness, and we've seen that out of Abraham already. But he's a friend of God. They have the similar characteristics about them, and this idea of mercy and compassion we're always going to see out of God, and we're seeing it here out of Abraham as well. It's not the idea of, I'm glad I don't live in Sodom. I'm glad that's not me. Hezekiah, King Hezekiah, he was like that. You know, that was the kind of guy he was. God had given him a lot of things. He gave him health. I mean, he was sick unto death, and God gave him health. And he lived, what, another 10 years, even though he was about to die. He kind of had that selfish streak about him, because when Isaiah, the prophet, told him, because he acted foolishly, you know, he told him, these are the terrible things that are going to befall the people of God. You know, there's destruction coming. He says, it's not going to be in your generation, but it's coming swiftly after. And what did Hezekiah say? He said, well, at least there'll be peace and prosperity in my time. Yeah. All right, that's okay. No, you know, it doesn't really hurt him. It doesn't affect him. And so Abraham's not sitting there thinking, well, glad I don't live in Sodom and Gomorrah, because they're about to go down. So in verse 26 says, so the Lord said, if I find in Sodom 50 righteous within the city, then I will spare all the place for their sakes. So once again, God is showing this extension of mercy here when he says, if there's 50 there that are righteous, I will spare the entire city for the sake of that 50. So God is willing to stretch out, and he is willing to bend. And this is, again, very important. We see him do this. He invites Moses in the same way. You know, when they're on Mount Sinai and God says, Moses, well, he doesn't say this exactly, but you know, you're not going to believe what's going on, you know, while you're up here and they're building a golden, they built a golden calf and they fall down and worship a golden calf. I'm going to go down there and destroy them, you know. And you think, what's going on here? Well, again, same situation. He's just inviting Moses to say, wait, you know, hold on a second. And what happened? Of course, God doesn't destroy him, of course. But, you know, it's this kind of language, it's this kind of communication that God is having with these individuals, desiring for them to say, hold on a second. Please don't destroy for the sake of goodness, for the sake of righteousness, for this or that. And so, you know, he wanted Abraham to argue for the cause of Lot, argue for the cause of the righteous. He wanted Moses to argue for the cause of the children of Israel. So let's not get mistaken here of God that, you know, he's ready to just throw fire down on anyone who turns against him right away. That's not what we see. And so the kind of language that we find with God on Mount Sinai or in this situation, we should not, you know, be blown away by that. Oh, God would just wipe them out just like that. No, that's not it. He's providing an opportunity for the righteous one before him, like Abraham or Moses, an opportunity for them to make intercession. So I think there's really good lessons there for us, really good lessons in terms of how we ought to use our time talking to God and the things that we can say on behalf of others, on behalf of our brethren, on behalf of our neighbors, on behalf of the faithful and the righteous. Because God wants us to talk about that. We see that right away, just like with Moses, here with Abraham, right away, he's willing to relent. He wants to relent. But he wants his people to speak up. So God says, sure, if there's 50 righteous, then I'll spare all the place. Spare it all. So verse 27, it says, then Abraham answered and said, indeed now, I, who am but dust and ashes, have taken it upon myself to speak to the Lord. Suppose there were five less than the 50 righteous. Would you destroy all the city for lack of five? So he said, if I find there 45, I will not destroy it. And he spoke to him yet again and said, suppose there were 40 found there. So he said, I will not do it for the sake of 40. Then he said, let not the Lord be angry, and I will speak. Suppose 30 should be found there. And he said, I will not do it if I find 30 there. And he said, indeed, now I have taken it upon myself to speak to the Lord. Suppose 20 should be found there. So he said, I will not destroy it for the sake of 20. Then he said, let not the Lord be angry, and I will speak what once more. Suppose 10 should be found there. And he said, I will not destroy it for the sake of 10. So the Lord went his way as soon as he had finished speaking with Abraham, and Abraham returned to his place. All right, now this is interesting. You know, Abraham, he just goes all the way down the line. I've always found just some humor in that. And I think what's interesting about this is how he just takes baby steps. And, you know, he doesn't go from a large number to, okay, but what if there's only one, you know? And you see the kind of character that Abraham has in the way that he does these baby step questions. The kind of respect that he has for God, as he doesn't just dive all the way in to, what if there's just one? It's interesting as well, he doesn't go all the way to the idea of just save Lot, which I think he could have. You know? In fact, I know he could. He could have went all the way down. What about just Lot? So Abraham has some interesting there's some interesting signs about his character and what in the all these questions he asks. And he stops at 10. He doesn't stop at Lot, just Lot, or just Lot and his wife, or just Lot and his wife and his two daughters. It's not like that. I mean, we've got four there. We have four. And four that make it out of Sodom, and of course, Lot's wife, you know, she makes it out, but you know, she doesn't come through alive, unfortunately. But we have four that left those gates before it was destroyed. We know that from the next chapter. But Abraham doesn't go down to four. He goes to 10. And again, I do believe Abraham, it was very familiar with what was going on in Sodom and Gomorrah, and very familiar with how many good people were in there, you know, righteous, faithful to God people were in there. And so I think that what Abraham does, we might look at it and think, oh, you're being pretty dangerous. But really, these step-by-step, small increment questions here is really showing his respect for God, even though I do believe Abraham could have asked for just Lot in this situation, or just any righteous, but rather he comes down to 10, even though Lot and his family don't appear to make 10 people. So I find that interesting. And look as well, we're dealing with the destruction of the city. So the idea is, if there's 10, if there's 10 that are righteous, then God wouldn't destroy any of them, right? All in the entire city, all the wicked people there, he wouldn't destroy any of them. So we know, you know, we'll just, for those who have read, you know, chapter 19 before, we know that God actually goes above and beyond everything that Abraham requested. And I find that, again, a very important application for us. Didn't Paul talk to the... my mind is just not working too well tonight. I want to say Philippians, it could be Colossians. He talked about how God... That God can do above and beyond all any and all that they could ask or think, right? Does anyone remember offhand which book that's in? Maybe it's Ephesians. Yeah, I'll end up going through all 66 books here. Anyway, I was just looking at that, and like I said, Ephesians. All right. Ephesians 3. That God can do anything above all that exceedingly abundantly is actually the term that Paul uses there. Can do exceedingly abundantly above all that we can ask or think. And I think something similar is going on here between God and Abraham. Is Abraham did stop at a stopping point, and his stopping point wasn't enough, actually, to save anyone in the city. Isn't that fascinating? Abraham's stopping point at 10 could not save Lot. So, God goes beyond all that. And so we're not dealing with this God who's here, and, oh, he just wants to destroy, he wants to kill. And Abraham's trying to stop him. Oh, what if there's 10? The fact is, God saved all the righteous. And so he certainly went beyond Abraham's request in that respect. But he also put down the wicked and setting that example it was an important example for Abraham and for his people to come, that they'd remember this, and that Abraham could teach his children and on and on and on each generation, that this is not the way to go. This is not the path. This is the path of judgment. This is the path of destruction. So God doing a number of things here, saving the righteous, as well as being a very just judge in what he did. And we'll see as we read chapter 19, we see how vile it is, you know. And so let's go ahead and start back in here, chapter 19. Let's go to verse 1. Now the two angels, which were called the two men that left, all right, this discussion between God and Abraham. Now the two angels came to Sodom in the evening, and Lot was sitting in the gate of Sodom. When Lot saw them, he rose to meet them, and he bowed himself with his face toward the ground. And he said, "Hear now, my lords, please turn in to your servant's house and spend the night and wash your feet. Then you may rise early and go your way." Now, you know, Lot, of course, he's very hospitable. We talked about the hospitality of Abraham in the previous chapter when these, quote, men showed up at his tent. And we questioned a lot of things, especially about Abraham, because Abraham knew that one of them was the Lord. This is the same way the Lord's appeared to him on many occasions before. You look at through earlier in the text. And so Abraham just jumping up and down and meeting every need, going and slaying an animal and just going all out crazy with a feast and everything. That's not just great ancient hospitality going on. That's the fact that he's about to God's visited him, you know, and so, obviously you're going to put your best foot forward. With Lot, this might be a similar thing. We don't know, with Lot, we don't know too well, you know, if he knew who these two men were, you know. Abraham knew better. I don't know if Lot did. Lot is obviously very hospitable here. Also, Lot sees strangers. Maybe he doesn't know that they're angels. Maybe he doesn't know they're from the Lord. He does see strangers coming into a very dangerous facility, all right? And he wants to be of assistance to them because they're, you know, may not make it through the night. It's a very dangerous place to live. And so he invites them to come to the house. And there's folks that say, Lot was at the gates, sitting at the gate of Sodom. They say, see, Lot was like an elder of the city, because in ancient times it was the elders that would sit at the city gates, and people would bring their problems to the city gates and bring whatever issues or need of counsel to the elders of the people. That sounds good, and that's about the size of it. You know, I think it is presumptuous to say that that's exactly what's going on. We know that that happens later on, but really we're talking about much later on. You know, in the days of the law of Moses and things like that. But we're jumping many, many, many years, hundreds and hundreds of years into the future. So we don't have secular history books that speak of these days, you know, speak of what the customs were in these days. We don't have any of that. So it's funny when people talk about these two chapters, 18 and 19, you see the hospitality of Abraham, the hospitality of Lot, and they say, well, you know, those ancient, you know, Eastern people, they were incredibly hospitable. And yes, they were, as far back as we can see in the external evidence of history books, but we can't see this far back. And so these guys might be just incredibly hospitable, or they might know who is before them, you know, that these are individuals who have come from the Lord. So I say all that to simply say that I don't know. I don't know why Lot was at the gate. Maybe he was an elder of the city. I don't know why he was so wanted to be so hospitable. Maybe that was their culture. Maybe he knew that these men were from God. Let's see. I stopped in the middle of verse, didn't I? You know, towards the end of verse 2, and they said, no, but we will spend the night in the open square. Verse 3, but he insisted strongly, so they turned in to him and entered his house. Then he made them a feast and baked unleavened bread, and they ate. Now before they lay down, the men of the city, the men of Sodom, both old and young, all the people from every quarter, surrounded the house. And they called to Lot and said to him, where are the men who came to you tonight? Bring them out to us that we may know them carnally. And this gives us a very good picture of what the city was like. You know, it's really sad. You know, this is not a pleasurable reading, you know. If you want pleasurable reading, go read the Psalms, you know. But if you want to see sin and wickedness and the judgment that befalls this kind of wickedness, go to Genesis 19. It was an example, right? That's what he said in chapter 18. This is going to be an example for Abraham's children. And then we come to the New Testament, and Peter opens that up for the whole church in his epistle in 2 Peter chapter 2, where he says that this was an example for us. Sodom and Gomorrah are an example that we should not do these things, be this way, act so wickedly, but we should be faithful to God. So we notice that, you know, Abraham's idea of 10 righteous is out the window, right? Because notice that verse 4, before they lay down, the men of the city, the men of Sodom, both old and young, all the people from every quarter surrounded the house. I don't know how many people that would be. You know, what are we dealing with? Probably somewhere in the thousands. I mean, If you got 1,000 people, that's a small city. And I don't think these cities on the plain were all that small. I mean, these were tremendous tremendous plots of land, right? In fact, isn't that why Lot chose, you know, that this whole area to live in and to have his flock out there outside of the gates of Sodom? Maybe that's why he was at the gate of Sodom, you know. But, you know, he's got his flock there. Green, you know. You have 5 cities here on the plain. Beautiful to behold the sights. That's why Lot wanted to do all this. And he chose sight over faith, right? Where Abraham is one who generally always chooses his faith over his sight, right? What's before his eyes. But when Abraham gave Lot the choice, what land do you want? Go this way, go that way, what do you want? And what does it say? That Lot saw. He saw a good land, better land than anything else that Abraham had to offer, and he took that land. And so he was using his sight, and he was looking at the material things, and so he goes over to this place of great wickedness, and what happens? He loses his wife. He loses sons-in-law, 2 future son-in-law. We'll get to that later. But and I'll tell you what, his daughters, they don't come out of this gold, you know. They don't come out of this situation. Let's put it this way. They come out of that city horribly mentally mangled, right? The city had an incredibly adverse effect on these 2 women. So, is that a good move? You know, this is a good move? Absolutely not. So, all the people, so we got, what do we got, thousands? That's what I was trying to say earlier. You know, this is good land. So these cities are probably bustling cities, right? This is probably not a small Arkansas town. This is probably in the thousands in population. All the men, young and old, all the people from every quarter, the entire city, all the people surrounding Lot's house. How terrifying. What do you think? Surrounding the house. Where are those men? You can imagine all the noise. I mean, this isn't just a night quiet and then just a knock on the door. I mean, you got all these people surrounding the entire house. Where are those men? Bring them out that we may know them carnally. Right? That's where sodomy gets its name, after all. Sodom, homosexuality. Bring them out. They may be abused in that way. Anyway, it's just, it's really, you know, it's not a fun chapter by any means. But we're out of time, so we'll pick back up there about verse 6 next Wednesday. Appreciate your attention in this study. I believe, Brother Doyle, you have the little invitation for us and an invitation song. I'll let you know in 2 seconds what that invitation song is. There it is. 3:23.